I welcome you to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word, and invite you to come to the very last chapter of the book of Job, Job chapter 42. Now, as we do our little verse-by-verse journey, I try to keep my eye on the clock for recording purposes, and sometimes I have to speed up, sometimes I have to slow down in order to get at a good cutoff point. Unfortunately, last time we were together, I just could not finish the book of Job appropriately. And so we just have a little bitty tiny piece of it left here at the beginning of today's session. So you know the story of Job, how Satan caused all sorts of grief in his life, and Job didn't know anything about that, and he was very upset and called out for God to answer him as to why all this was happening. And then his friends show up, and they accuse him of being a sinner because the philosophy that they were all acting upon was that bad things only happen to bad people. And of course, that was not true, still isn't true to this day. But Job was raked over the coals by those men. And then finally, God shows up. God chides Job a little bit because Job was pushing against God, insisting, "You owe me an explanation," that sort of thing. And so God kind of says, "Look, you've been wanting to depose me in a court of law. How about I depose you first? You tell me what you know about this stuff. And then we'll see whether or not you can understand the stuff that's just happened to you." And he talked about creation, talked about two particular premier animals, the Behemoth and the Leviathan. And Job, of course, finishes by saying, "I'm going to shut my mouth. I shouldn't have demanded you come and explain it. I'm going to repent in dust and ashes." And then it's over. Other than God chewed out all three of the friends, and I think the fourth guy as well, for their sinful behavior, for the sinful things they had said, and demanded that they repent and use Job as their intermediary in having sacrifices made on their behalf and getting the forgiveness that they needed, much more than Job needed any such forgiveness. And so that, just real fast, is the summary of the book of Job. Now, the finish of it is how God restored that which had been lost. Now, it's not exactly the same thing, but there is a replacement. So Job 42:10, "He who is restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And he who is gave Job twice as much as he had before." Now that's about his stuff, not his kids. He gives him twice as much material profit as he had before. Verse 11, "Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that he who is had brought upon him." So even here at the end of the book, we have a problem with wording, that some of the people would use the language that God did this stuff, when in fact we know from chapters 1 and 2, God didn't do the stuff. We have something similar in insurance clauses, which talk about, quote, acts of God, end quote. And usually they mean things like weather events. And that's not accurate about those events being direct consequences of God's choice. Some of them might be, but the vast majority of them are just part of the natural weather patterns of this fallen world. So it might just be, we'd say, the sort of vocabulary that we're accustomed to. And so they were comforting him for all the bad stuff that happened to him. Now, they had previously kind of shied away from him because they, too, probably believed that bad things only happen to bad people. But now that's been taken care of. And they may have actually helped him get restarted with the next thing. And each of them gave him a piece of money, is what our English Standard Version uses here. It's a generic term for something of value. And a ring of gold. So my guess is some silver and some gold. And with that starter capital, I believe he went out and bought replacement animals and hired replacement servants. And over a relatively short period of time, God blesses him. And it says, he who is blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And then we already know he's going to end up with twice as much as he had when he lost it. He had 14,000 sheep now, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, which means at least 2,000, and 1,000 female donkeys, and probably some breeding donkeys, breeding male donkeys that go along with that. And so he is even more wealthy than he was before. He has even more employees than he had before. And he also ends up with kids. Now, they're not going to be perfect replacements for the ones that he lost, but they will help his heart and the heart of his wife that was also hit with loss in this whole story. And interestingly enough, he ends up with as many kids in his restart that he had in his pre-disaster life. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now, in this time around, though, we're told a little bit about the kids' names. He called the name of the first daughter Yamima, which, interesting, has something to do with day by day. You know, the equivalent to our phrase, one day at a time, which is always an encouragement to just hang in there. The name of the second daughter was Gaziah, which I think has to do with cassia, which is an ingredient in perfumes and in incense. So it smells very beautiful. And the name of the third was Gerin Habuk. Gerin is a horn, which sometimes is used as a container. Habuk is antimony, which is a cosmetic, I believe. And so he basically names his daughters pretty things or a reminder that we live our lives day by day. Verse 15, and in all the land there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers, which was unusual back at that time. But Job has had his life impacted by his events. And so he apparently decided that all 3 of his daughters should get a piece of his properties upon his demise, because they were of value to him. And then verse 16. And before I read it, let me remind you that this whole time I've been telling you, my best guess was that Job was somewhere in his 40s whenever these events occurred and he lost everything. If that is true, then his restart, raising his kids, would have taken another 20 years. So that would throw him into his 60s whenever his kids are old enough to kind of move out on their own and start their own families and have grandkids for Job and Mrs. Job. And so how did the rest of his life go after that? Well, verse 16 says, after this, Job lived 140 years, and he saw his sons and his sons' sons four generations worth. So if he had been 40 years old, or thereabouts, when the crisis hit, then he must have lived until he was 180, somewhere in his 180s. That's my guess. And that matches, generally speaking, the long lives of the patriarchs that I think are not far displaced from the time of this this storyline here. And so all of that seems to help us be confident that we're in the right time period for the book of Job. And then Job died, an old man, full of days, and blessed. And that ends the story of the prophet Job. And in the New Testament, of course, he is referred back to as a man with great patience, a man who could stick with God despite the circumstances going on in his life. And that is certainly the type of example we need to live up to. Let us now turn our attention to the book of Exodus. We had mentioned that the book of Genesis immediately slides into the book of Exodus in telling this story. In fact, when you study these books in Hebrew, you find out that the book of Exodus actually starts with the conjunction and. So it is a direct continuation of the story in the book of Genesis. So Exodus chapter 1, verse 1 says, and, that's the Hebrew, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his own household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Then you've got the concubines' kids, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. Now, all the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. And back in Genesis 46, you remember we had this count of the specific male descendants that kind of the clans of Israel start getting their names from. These were the ones that were in Egypt or brought down to Egypt or very soon after were born in Egypt as that next generation. And so that is the start of the Israelis as a people group. Now Joseph, of course, dies. Verse 6, Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. We talked about Joseph's death back in Genesis chapter 50, and that happened right around 1815 B.C. in the chronology that I use. And that would have been the tail end of the 12th dynasty of Egypt. And it matches exactly what we know. Joseph seems to have come to prominence under Senusrit III, Senusrit II, and then they started doing all of the preps during the good 7 years, and we know that Senusrit II did a lot of work on expanding agricultural works right around the Fayum oasis, as a matter of fact. Then He died, and the next pharaoh was his son, Sennacherib III, and so Joseph would have been working for him when the famine comes. And we know that Joseph ends up taking the silver and gold of the people of Egypt, particularly the nobles of Egypt, and then he takes their property, their animal property, then he takes their physical property, and then he even confiscates their individual freedom. And we are told historically that Sennacherib III brought the entire land of Egypt underneath his control, so that everyone pretty much worked for him. It was a centralized government under a single autocrat. And everybody worked his land and paid 20%. This is the Joseph numbers to the Pharaoh for the ability to work on Pharaoh's property. So that all matches the 12th dynasty. Now, what happens is that eventually the 12th dynasty starts losing steam, starts losing effectiveness. And I honestly think that once Joseph was out of the picture, maybe when he retired and definitely when he died, the 12th dynasty kind of lost the person that was keeping them going and effective. And so by just about a dozen years after Joseph's death, the 12th dynasty came to an end. And we end up with several dynasties in a row being all not all that prominent or effective. And eventually, you end up with a bunch of Semites from Canaan moving in to the Delta, just like Israel had done. And by the time we get to about the, I think it's the 14th dynasty, those Semites are running things. They take it over. They take over the kingdom of Egypt. And the pureblood Egyptians, and keep in mind, Semites are from the genetic line of Shem, while the Egyptians come from the genetic line of Ham. So there's a little bit of generic variation between them. And so the pureblood Egyptians lose control of the Nile Delta area, which is called Lower Egypt because it's lower in elevation. And they move their control southward. They're still along the Nile River, but they're away from the Delta. And sometime during all of that period of disruption and uncertainty, that's when we have the explosion of the Israeli population. Verse number 7, "But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." So the Israelis are just multiplying like crazy. Now, we already know that Jacob's family had 12 boys and one named girl, but there's almost certainly more girls in the family than that. And so we're talking about more than a dozen kids that one couple was raising. If you can imagine that each one of those started having large families as well, and then those families' kids grow up and have big families, it's not going to take very long before you have tens of thousands and then eventually hundreds of thousands of Israelis living in the Delta, land of Goshen, or living around other parts of the Delta and up and down the Nile, where they are working and carrying on life. And those Israelis are going to be thinking of themselves as united. They would consider themselves distinct than any of the other groups around them. I mentioned the idea that Semites were coming in as well from the land of Canaan and taking over from the pure-blood Egyptians. But those Semites would have been different than the Israelis. And so the Israelis are kind of a group to themselves, and they think of themselves in that way. And when you have a group like that, that kind of keeps to themselves, has unique customs, other people find them a little bit frightening. They see them as a threat, especially if there's a bunch of them. And so that is why verse 18 makes perfect sense in this time period that we're talking about, where there's upheaval in Egypt with lots of different people groups trying to vie for control of the land. Verse 8, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So this guy doesn't know the story of Joseph, that he was a savior, that he saved the population from a seven-year famine through divine intervention. And so all he sees is a dangerous people group. Now, who is this pharaoh? Is it a Semite pharaoh? You know, one of the Huksos, that's the Greek word that gets applied to the Semite kingdom of the 14th dynasty, the foreign kings. Or was it a new pure-blood Egyptian at the very beginning of the 15th dynasty? Because we know that right around the beginning of the 16th century BC, a man by the name of Amos the First gets it in his head that Egypt ought to be for Egyptians. And so he was living, as his family had for quite some time, in southern Egypt. But he wants lower Egypt back. He wants the Delta back. And so he goes on a military campaign, and he kicks the foreign rulers out. And then he adopts a very xenophobic approach to everybody else. Xenophobia means fear of strangers, or more specifically, fear of others, fear of anybody not of my group. So in this case, pure-blood Egyptians don't want anyone in control other than pure-blood Egyptians. And so it's sometime during this whole upheaval, the Israelis now start looking like a danger. And so the Pharaoh, whoever it was, verse number 9, said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. And so the idea in verse 10 is a little conference between the Pharaoh and other Egyptians saying, these guys don't belong to us. They are the other. There's a bunch of them. And if we have an invasion, they might join the invaders. So we've got to do something to control them. Verse 11, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. So at some point, the Israelis lost their freedom. They were turned into slaves. And it says they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. Now, I'm going to warn you again that just because you see the name Ramesses here, and there is a Pharaoh that is named Ramesses, it doesn't mean that the city was named after the king. The name Ramesses has to do with the god Ra, or Re, the sun god. The Menses part has to do with a flowing out from. And so Ramesses was a city somewhere probably close to the city the Greeks later called Heliopolis, the city of the sun, which Ramesses was therefore in the land of Goshen. And so what's happening is that the Egyptians are making the Israelis build them storehouses. Now, that's rather ironic because the Israeli hero, Joseph, helped the Egyptians build store cities in order to save them from the great 7-year famine. But now they're turned into slaves for agricultural purposes. But it kind of backfires. Verse 12, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. So instead of tamping down the population growth of the Israelis, them having to do all this work seems to have turned the population up. And it's not just that they were in the Delta region, they're also everywhere else, up and down the Nile. So they are making pockets of Israelis everywhere. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel.